Welcome, everyone. Today is April 27th, 2017. This is the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and we are going to open it up with a work session on Senate Bill 3.
Public hearing.
So used to work session. All right, we're opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 310. I'm sure the advocates for Senate Bill 310 would love to have it be a work session. Representative Buehler. And anyone else that wants to come up and talk about it? Aaron Doyle, Cadence Petros. And this may sound a little familiar to you all. Cassie, do you want to read a quick summary?
Yeah. Senate Bill 310 authorizes a city or county to designate vertical housing development zone within jurisdictions and removes Oregon Housing and Community Services Department from the designation process. The bill establishes requirements for a city or county to certify vertical housing development projects within the zone. It becomes operative January 1st, 2018, and takes effect the 91st day after signee die.
I'll let you guys start.
Good morning. Tara Ginnick-Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, Aaron Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. Senate Bill 310, like was indicated, is a bill that you've heard before. Early in the session is House Bill 2773. It's a simple shift of oversight of the Vertical Housing Development Zone program from the state OHCS to the cities and counties that would potentially be enacting the Vertical Housing Zone program within their city. Just to give you a brief reminder, currently a city designates a specific area within the city limits as a vertical housing development zone, and the projects that would be placed in that zone and receive a property tax abatement would have a mixed use of commercial on the usually the first floor and then residential above. Within that zone, for each floor of housing the development produces, the building receives a 20% tax abatement on the improvements of the value after it's built. And if there is an equalized floor of affordable housing, it can receive an additional 20% property tax abatement on the value of the land. This program helps cities work to bring targeted dense development, and in some communities it's been used for rehabilitating the main street type area. In our smaller communities and in our larger communities has been used to get density built, generally along transit or other beneficial uses of high density housing that might otherwise be difficult to finance to build. I will say that there is an amendment that is currently being drafted. We are working with the Speaker's office on it that's related to consideration of the potential for displacement in using this program. It would be some sort of moment in which the city has to reflect if this developing this zone in a particular area would have a displacing effect on the current residents of the area. So we're working to make sure that that fits within the bill and gets the policy outcomes that the Speaker would like. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cadence Petros. I'm the Development Division Manager at the City of Beaverton. My job is twofold. First is to help ensure an adequate supply of affordable housing in the city, but also to help Beaverton identify and revitalize its downtown area. And today I'm here to speak on support of Senate Bill 310. As Aaron explained the nuts and bolts of the program, I'm here just to let you know how it works on the ground. And since this program was reauthorized in 2015, Beaverton now has three projects that are either recently open or just about to start construction that will result in about 352 new units in our downtown. That's big for us. All of these units are well served by transit, and one in particular, the Westgate project, is a piece of property that the city has owned since 2004. It's almost 4 acres directly adjacent to light rail. We have been unable to redevelop that piece of land for a long, long time. But now, with the help of vertical housing and some urban renewal funds, we are about to have a private developer break ground on approximately 230 units, some of which which will be affordable units due to the toolkit that Beaverton has. They'll be making use of the vertical housing tax abatement, and it's a critical piece in order to make these projects pencil. We're getting greater density than we otherwise would and creating a really vibrant downtown, which is not only beneficial to the folks who will be living there, but for our entire community. The vertical housing program is a targeted, valuable economic investment tool that has attracted more housing and commercial development to the city. It is one of our overall pieces of our overall strategy. So it's a piece of our overall toolbox, both for economic development purposes, but also for housing. Because when we look at our housing issues, it's the full spectrum of housing that we want to have in the city. We absolutely need more affordable housing, and we're working on developing that toolkit every day. And to have a complete community, we also, particularly in downtown Beaverton, need more market rate housing. And so the full complement of these tools is what we're trying to establish in Beaverton to make sure that we have all the resources at our disposal to make a complete community. So with that, I'd like to say I urge you to pass Senate Bill 310 out of committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Newt Buehler. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. I'm here to lend my support to the Senate bill. Like, if you remember, we had a very similar, I think exactly the similar, House bill. But since the Senate bill so quickly went through the process, we kind of focused on supporting it. My other message is this is just not about Metro. The city of Bend is also very interested in this concept. We have two problems that we want to solve in Central Oregon. One is more affordable housing, and the second is to increase density. And we see this as an excellent vehicle to help us achieve both of those goals. So I'm fully in support, and I urge your yes vote.
Questions from anybody? I have a question about this bill is really simply an administrative transfer. Mm-hmm. So my question is about the bigger program that's really not up for discussion today, but I'm curious for the future. I know that we're doing 20% right now. The program is 20% of a tax property tax abatement just for the vertical housing piece and another 20% for the affordability piece. I believe the affordability piece of it has not been used by a lot of the vertical housing. There's, you know, I looked into this when I first heard this. Can we increase that? But that's not the relating to clause. That's not what's up for discussion. Is, you know, rejiggering the actual program. Mm-hmm. All this bill does is transfer the management of it from OHCS to the cities. So I get that, but I'm just curious for our future thinking. Why is it that the 20% is needed for vertical? Is it that it's more expensive to do vertical because you think economy of scale, yeah, it should be cheaper? But then I've heard no, yeah, because after a certain point you got to use steel or something. Yeah. So that's one question, is why is it needed so much on that side? And then do you have any ideas about how we could, because it's a great opportunity for more, yeah, mixed income housing in downtown areas. Do you have ideas about how we could make the affordability piece more attractive in the future?
Well, I'll address your first aspect of it, of why do we need to encourage verticalization. And that's a really interesting question, because you think it would just kind of naturally occur because you can add a lot more value. And we've encountered this in Bend because we have not been able to expand the urban growth boundary like many people would like to. So there's big incentive to build on some of these lots that have been there, say a single ranch style house on a couple acre lot, and it's very very much in demand. You think you'd put up a you know, multi-story, mm-hmm, building pretty quickly, but I call it status quo inertia. Mm. Right, someone owns that ranch house, they're renting it out, they are happy with the $2,000 a month. It's a lot of risk, a lot of work, and maybe it's an older person who's happy with where they are right there. And so there needs to be more incentive to develop those into somewhat of a risky, expensive multi-story building. Mm-hmm.
I'd add to that and say, even if you have a developer that sees the potential of a site like that, they don't bring all the money to the table. Mm-hmm. And so in Beaverton, for example, we're pushing the market by having more vertical development. They're pushing the market on rents. They're pushing the market on the height of the building. And so they need both debt and equity to come into these projects, and they require a certain return. So it's easy to think that, you know, a developer just comes in, they're going to do whatever makes the most money. But the reality is there's a math piece to it, mm-hmm. and it has to pencil. And so the vertical housing tax abatement allows for that pro forma, both the capital and the operating pro forma, to work. And that's one of the reasons why it's so beneficial. I've talked to the developer who's done one project that's open in Beaverton and the one that's going to break ground to ask about this question, how could we make the affordability more attractive? And it all comes down to the numbers. So the fear is first that you make it mandatory, right? Mm-hmm. And then it blows it out, because the rents that are foregone when you make some of those units affordable directly impacts the operating pro forma. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we'd have to do to make vertical housing, the affordable component, more attractive is figure out what are the added benefits. Right now, if you add the offer of tax exemption for the land, that's such a small part of the overall property tax bill that it's not the numbers can't even out, right? They're giving up more than they're receiving. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have to figure out together, I think, with a group of like-minded developers as well as housing advocates, what are the tools? And then ask honestly, is vertical housing the right tool to add to? Or are there other tools that are more easily created that will get us the same result? Mm-hmm.
If I may, the other piece that we kind of haven't talked about is the part that's rehabilitation in the Main Street area, having just that little bit of incentive. That property might already exist. It might have a couple of housing units on top of it, but it hasn't been used as housing for a while. It's in disrepair. And by doing a 20% tax abatement on the improvements, they see the benefit of adding those units back into that particular zone or area, which can actually add to economic development. So it's a tool for both sides of the equation. Originally, this program was placed in Business Oregon and then was moved over to OHCS because it was seen as an economic development tool. It's both, honestly. And so I think that some of those original projects were a little bit smaller, so there wasn't as much of a push of towards the affordable. And we have to keep that in mind so the tool becomes useful for everyone. I think that's why we get away from the mandatory in this program. But the other piece of it that we sometimes don't talk about is the fact that this isn't the only program that some of these developments are being are utilizing. And so they'll do a stacking of different types of abatements and programs by which maybe the affordability doesn't come in because of the vertical housing development zone, but affordability will come in from other programs that the city or county or region is working on, and adding the incentives in that manner. So they might not necessarily do the development project itself using the affordability abatement, but will add affordability using other programs that leverage more funding and make the penciled out math actually pencil out.
So what's the definition of vertical? How to qualify for it? How much do you have to go up?
Two stories.
Stories of residential?
So it's one story of commercial and one story of residential. And so if there's only one story of residential, you only get the 20% on the improvements. For the second story, you get 40%. For the third story, you get 60% of the improvements. And for the fourth story and greater, you only get 80% of the improvements value.
It's 20% per floor.
20% per floor. Up to 80% of the value of the improvements. So if you look at the numbers, every property that's been developed that I've been able to delve into county tax assessment, mm-hmm. which I don't recommend to anyone, we make more money at the end of the day because the improvements add such value once they are actually used and are bringing in rents or people are purchasing the units. So we're not seeing a total tax loss, but we're giving enough that it makes the development work.
Okay, interesting. Well, we had so many bills first time around that it was hard to wrap my head around every single one, and I've had several conversations since we heard this last time, but I think it's great. I think Bend has some beautiful examples.
And we have one that's been very successful. Yeah. And they're looking at doing another one.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, no other questions? Thank you very much for bringing this back. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 310, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 17. And let's see, I've got Joe Defoe here. And Cassie, could you please read the summary?
Senate Bill 17 removes the requirement that the superintendents of the Oregon State Hospital and Department of Corrections designate a chief medical officer for their institutions. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Good morning, Chair Kenninger, committee members. My name is Joe Defoe. I'm the Health Service Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to support and testify with Senate Bill 17. Current statute authorizes the superintendent to designate a physician licensed by the Oregon Medical Board to serve as the chief medical officer for that institution, who is directly responsible to the superintendent for the administration of medical treatment programs and assume such other responsibilities as are assigned by the superintendent. Within this department today, this task falls to the centralized medical director rather than the facility superintendent. Recently, we've been challenged on the Court of Appeals decision invalidated the current administrative rule that allows the central chief medical director to appoint the CMO. Although the statute that exists, the DOC director authority to delegate responsibilities specifically requires a superintendent to appoint the chief medical officer for the superintendent's institution, which takes priority over the broad authority of the director. If passed, this legislation would allow the chief medical officer of the central division to designate a licensed physician to serve as the chief medical officer for the treatment programs at each institution, which will bring statute in line with DOC's current practice and health services policy by repealing Section 1F of ORS 179-360 in its entirety. For that reason explained above, the department asks this committee to vote Senate Bill 17 out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for your time and any questions.
Very reasonable. Thank you for coming to my office ahead of time to explain it.
Sure.
Like
I would have liked you to come to my office.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I need you to go back to that place where you said that there was a challenge against it and explain to me, help me understand what that was
about. Okay, so years ago when the first Oregon statute was created, that the superintendent of the institution would appoint the CMO, we had two or three institutions. Now we have 14. Mm-hmm. We got a central division. One of the adults in custody challenged us on that rule that the central cannot appoint because of the original statute. Mm-hmm. And the Court of Appeals agreed and said you cannot appoint from a central division. The original ORS says it must be the superintendent. So we do have letters from the superintendent appointing the CMO, so we're currently in compliance. But as we move forward, we really would prefer the chief medical director of Central to do the appointing.
Okay. What was helpful for me when you explained the history was that when this statute was created, there were only one or two
Oregon State Penitentiary.
And now they're 14. So it made sense for the to be done that way, but now that they're 14, you really need one person to be able to.
And they're qualified. The superintendents are superintendents in the institution. The chief medical officer, director for the central, is a physician as well. So he's the one with the most knowledge and profession to appoint.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
I'll follow up, please. Thank you. So I understand that piece and the logic behind it. I guess I was curious about the challenge and what benefit the challenge would have made for the individual who made it.
Chair Kenninger and committee, I don't know the motivation other
frivolous.
Than he just challenged us and
okay. All right.
He was right.
Okay, thanks so much.
I had heard it, this hearsay, that the person has a lot of time and is going through statutes to make sure that rules and statutes line up, and it's actually doing a service to the state by making sure that we're in compliance.
Oh. Or something to do.
Yeah. But actually, it's fine that we clean up our statutes and make sure they're aligning with what the best practice is right now. So,
okay.
No other questions? We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 17. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 821. We've got Ryan Fisher here, and Cassie, could you please read the summary?
Senate Bill 821 directs Oregon Housing Stability Council to consult with Community Action Partnership of Oregon in developing policy for awarding grants to organizations from the emergency housing account, including aligning with federal homelessness prevention strategies.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, members of the committee. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, which is a statewide network of community action agencies, 18 of them, which serve all 36 counties in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 821. I will be brief today, but take advantage of this opportunity to once again tell you just how critical the emergency housing account is. This is something that addresses folks who are either experiencing homelessness or at risk of becoming homeless. These funds are extremely flexible and used by the community action agencies to work with all of the other funds that they're able to receive, either through private donations or through federal sources. And these emergency housing account funds are able to really stitch together what these other resources are able to do and help folks with the little things that sometimes you don't think about. They're often used to help with getting that deposit in so that you can move into a place. Maybe you've got some rent assistance set up in place, like a housing choice voucher, but you don't have the resources to be able to get into the unit, and the emergency housing account can be helpful for that. For a lot of families that are experiencing homelessness and have a lot of barriers that they need to overcome to be able to get into housing, the emergency housing account funds can be used for case management to help those folks. I know in the city of Portland, there is a pool of funds, the short-term rental assistance funds, sometimes called STRAW, which are used for rent assistance. The EHA funds can be a part of that STRAW fund, but also they can be used to cover the case management so that folks who are working with families are able to then draw down those STRAW funds, but also provide those supports to families. So in that way, it's able to leverage those short-term rental assistance funds as well. So an extremely important resource. And this bill gets to that issue of flexibility. So one of the ways that the emergency housing account is critical is that it allows, it works as a match in order to bring in some federal funding, such as the continuum of care funds. In order to serve that role, to provide the match, the allowable uses of the emergency housing account have to be parallel with those federal funding sources. And the way that the allowable uses of the emergency housing account are determined here in Oregon, because this is a state resource, is the statute lays out these are the sort of the sideboards around which the emergency housing account can be used, and then the state housing council within those sideboards determines, okay, we're going to set rules, and this is how the emergency housing account, these are allowable uses and not allowable uses. What we've seen is that sometimes the federal funding sources can change, and potentially it might be outside of the very specific language of the emergency housing account. So the state housing council doesn't have the statutory ability to match up with what those federal resources can do. So rather than trying to change the statute every time there's a change at the federal level, what this bill does is it adds as another parameter that the Housing Stability Council can use to match federal resources and strategies. And so that gives them the flexibility to make any additional allowable uses that are in line with federal uses of those resources. So that's the primary thing that this bill accomplishes. The other piece is the Community Action Partnership of Oregon serves as an advisory body to housing and community services in other areas. And so it adds a line that when the Housing Stability Council will determine the allowable uses of the emergency housing account, it will do so with the advice of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. Now, technically, The Housing Stability Council doesn't have to follow that advice, but we want to make sure that that opportunity is there so that the folks who are on the ground delivering the resources have an opportunity to provide input into what would be meaningful to them. And also, typically, they're closely tracking the allowable uses of those federal resources, and so they can provide that input as well. So those are the two pieces that the bill accomplishes, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Fisher, for presenting that. And I just had a question related to the emergency housing account. You mentioned some of the funding resources for that. Are you aware of any other current programs that we're trying to help fund this program, the emergency housing in SHAF? Is that right?
Yes. The other state general fund resource that goes through Housing and Community Services to the community action agencies is the State Housing Assistance Program.
Yeah.
And that is a resource that actually was in place prior to the creation of the emergency housing account. It's slightly more narrow in terms of the allowable uses for the State Homeless Assistance Program. It's typically used for shelters. It can be used for motel vouchers. And I think there are some other uses as well. I know that sort of my family likes to play set subset. All berries are fruit, but not all fruits are berries. We do that at the dinner table. You can apply that here to the State Homeless Assistance Program. Everything you can do with the State Homeless Assistance Program, you can do with EHA. Not everything that you can do with EHA can be done with the State Homeless Assistance Program.
And follow up.
Or State Housing Assistance Program. Yes.
What is one of my questions is, what is the main funding source for EHA SHAP?
Oh, thank you, Chair Gannigeyer, Representative Meek. It is general fund. It's the primary source of funding. The other force, though, which is incredibly important, is the document recording fee. And so the document recording fee, 10% of it goes toward the emergency housing account, and a quarter of the funds that come out of the document recording fee are reserved to serve veterans. And so that is a really important addition to the general fund allocation.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate that.
Thank you. I'd love to follow up on Representative Meek's question. So the right now, the emergency, doc recording fee brings in $14 million a year. Mm-hmm. So that would be $1.4 million going to emergency housing. And the traditional amount coming out of the general assistance fund over the last biennium was $5 million. Then we made a $10 million increase in the last year of the biennium. But it's been $5 million a year. What is it in the budget right now under the general fund?
Thank you, Chair Kinnegeyer. The current service level would be that $5 million per year plus the cost of living, or the CSL increase, which I believe is around 2%. In the governor's recommended budget, it was maintained at that current service level, and in the co-chair's framework, it was not identified on the targeted cuts list, and so we assume that would mean that it is in that budget also at the current service level.
Right, so, without the additional bump that we gave it last time.
Without the additional bump. So you may recall the exciting, animated presentation that I had about the emergency housing account that I accidentally let the big punchline up before building up to it. Those one-time funds of $10 million mean that right now, in terms of general fund, there is $15 million available in the state for the emergency housing account. Even at that current service level, there would be about a 66% reduction in terms of available funds. And I can say that even with those additional resources out there right now, I've heard, for instance, from Central Oregon, they're able to serve less than 1 out of 20 folks that come in needing assistance in the Benton County, Linn County, and Lincoln County Community Action Agency. They've reported it's around 1 in 15 or 16 folks that come in needing assistance. So there is tremendous demand for this resource right now.
That's even with the $10 million increase. Right?
Chair Kinnegeyer, correct.
So going back to your bill, the part of it that you first described, adding the language that allows one of the criteria to be aligning with federal resources, would allow for more of a match. It would allow them to draw down federal funds.
Chair Kinnegeyer, yes. And currently,
We historically have been using this for this purpose, and this is just to ensure that we are able to continue doing so without there being any issues with some of these recent changes and potential future changes to the allowable uses of those federal resources.
Okay, because our criteria happens to have aligned, but if the feds change their criteria, then we may not be able to unless we change the language.
Chair Kindergarten, that's correct. Thank you.
Thank you. And the second part about wanting to make sure that the community action agencies have a seat at the table in advising the Housing Council on the grants. Have you had any ability to give advice formally, informally, to date? And how do you see this going forward? Because the language is very vague with advice from the community action agencies. Are you hoping to be have a seat at the table at the Housing Stability Council? Or is there any kind of vision that you have for how this might get enacted?
Chair Kindergeyer, thank you for the question. As I mentioned, the Community Action Partnership already has an advisory role in other areas. And so collaboratively with the agency, we have worked out mechanisms where we can efficiently provide that that advice. There have been in the past joint meetings with the Housing Stability Council and the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. And that has been a great forum for the exchange of ideas. The Housing Stability Council traditionally, prior to some reorganization recently, had really focused on the multifamily development side of the Housing and Community Services Agency. This is my perspective, having gone to many of those council meetings and working with the department, whereas the Community Action Partnership of Oregon was providing advice more on the community services side of things. The reorganization has brought the Housing Stability Council to have more interest and interaction with that community services side, which is a very good thing because the two are integrated services and needs within the state. So the Community Action Partnership of Oregon would typically what they do is they work together as a as an organization. They put together recommendations that work in rural and urban areas, and then they provide that that advice to the agency, and we would expect that a similar format would be used for the Housing Stability Council to say, you know, if we know that the Housing Stability Council is going to be making some adjustments to the emergency housing accounts uses, we would then put together that advice and present it to them before they make that decision.
Okay. Thanks. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 821 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 949. We've got Kendall Mason. Yeah, Cassie, please read the summary.
Senate Bill 949 makes non-competition agreements and employment contracts for home care workers voidable by the home care worker. The bill also makes a covenant between the employer and the home care worker voidable when the covenant prohibits transacting business with customers or soliciting other employees.
Hi. Chair Kindergarten, Vice Chair Sanchez, thanks for having me here today to talk a little bit about Senate Bill 949A. I'll keep my testimony brief, but I'd like to point you to some of the materials that are already in OLIS from public hearings on the Senate side with this bill. It includes some cease and desist.
You said your name, right?
Name. Yes. Oh, my name is Kendall Mason. My apologies. I work for 503, SEIU 503, as a policy strategist. But again, back to the materials in OLIS, there's some copies of some cease and desist letters that home care workers and consumers have been receiving from various agencies. And there's also testimony from Gracia Molina, who was unable to be here today but wanted to. And it just sort of details her experience being threatened with a cease and desist in a lawsuit of $40,000 when she tried to when she moved her services to the Oregon Home Care Commission, and one of her consumers wanted to come with her because he really liked working with her and appreciated her care. And when they switched, they were threatened with lawsuits and and such. So we don't currently believe that home care workers should be eligible to sign a non-compete, but that doesn't prevent a lot of agencies from making them sign them, as well as covenants of non-solicitation. So we would just thought we would make it crystal clear and create an exemption for them, as well as address the covenant of non-solicitation.
Any questions? There appears to be no opposition when it was on the Senate side as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 949. Open up public hearing on Senate Bill 834. And contacts Senator Gelser. Okay, we're going to stand at ease for a couple minutes. Senator Gelser, this is her bill, and she's part of a quorum on an issue right now in the next room over. So stand at ease. Okay, we're reopen the committee and reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 834. Thank you, Senator Gelser, for being here. Cassie, please read the summary.
Senate Bill 834 requires Department of Human Services to develop a proposal for establishing an independent human rights commission to safeguard dignity and human rights for individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities. The bill requires DHS to report findings and their proposal to the Legislative Assembly by December 1st, 2017, and repeals the proposal development on December 31st, 2017. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Good morning, Chair Kinney-Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and members of the committee. For your record, I'm Sarah Gelser, State Senator from Corvallis in Albany. Pleased to bring this bill over your way, along with my good friend and favorite travel companion, Representative Peluso. Oh, except for Representative Stark is also a favorite travel companion. Sorry.
China.
I like to travel with this committee.
Yay.
Let's go on a trip. So Senate Bill 834 is about a very simple idea, that all of us should have the basic right to make decisions about what we do every day. Really basic things like, do I feel like taking a shower? And do I prefer to take a shower in the morning or in the evening? Do I want mint chip ice cream or do I want vanilla ice cream or do I want no ice cream at all? Do I want my coffee to be caffeinated or decaffeinated? Do I want to have visitors over after 10 o'clock? Do I want a date? Do I want to watch scary shows on cable television? Unfortunately, for too many individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, well-meaning individuals that care for them, people like me, I'm a parent of an adult with a developmental disability and have to remind myself of this all the time, will make decisions that limit those basic choices. So what this bill would do is create, and many states have these, it would ask the department to create a commission that basically provides oversight around individual restrictions that are put on these basic choices that people make, to make sure that those have been made in consultation with the individual and that they are not unnecessarily restricting the rights of a person. I can give you an example of a couple of these things that I've seen in Oregon while visiting different types of places. In one case, I was talking with an individual that was very frustrated and angry. He was having some issues, behavior-related issues, actually. And part of what he said he was angry about was he was told it wasn't good for him to watch cable television. So he was not able to access cable television or watch things on TV. There was not a court order or a medical order that said that television couldn't be watched. It was just his caregivers had decided that was not appropriate for him to do. But he was an adult. And I imagine any of you, we all may have things that we like to watch that are not appropriate. Along with the state treasurer, I have occasionally watched The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. Probably not the most appropriate thing, but I have the opportunity to make that bad choice. I would say the same is true a lot. This will come up with food. You know, especially at this time of session in the late afternoon, I kind of like those chips, and I shouldn't eat them. They are not good for me. But I have the right to make that decision to eat those potato chips and deal with the consequences when I put my skirt on the next morning. And those are our rights that really should belong to everyone. We take them for granted, but they are things that individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities often aren't able to exercise despite the best intentions of everyone else. And again, this is not a criticism of family members, guardians, friends, caregivers, and service providers. As the parent of an adult with an intellectual disability, I have to catch myself. So if my son is watching something that I think is inappropriate, I will share with him, you know, this makes me uncomfortable. How does it make you feel? Do you think that this is a good idea? What kind of dreams are you going to have tonight? And then give him the opportunity to make those choices that belong to him and not to me. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Vice Chair Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I read this piece that made me think, oh, my God, I want to ask this question because it's that, where'd it go? how to guarantee the independence of the commission from influence by service providers and the department. It has been my experience, you clearly understand this yourself, that oftentimes it is the parent with the biggest influence, and how that parent then might influence that commission is a concern that I have.
So, Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Sanchez, the way that the process is set up right now in terms of service provision and the writing of a service plan, you cannot be, so we can have a parent that is paid as a service provider, and where this is going to come up is where there is where there's a service plan where it's something that's written. I mean, the department, you know, even the example that I gave, I don't imagine that this entity that DHS would set up would have the ability to come and talk to me about how I'm, and I need to change the way I'm using those words, about how my son is able to access his rights while he's living in my home. It would kick in the more formal setting if he were to move out of my home, and then where I am in that service plan. Within that service plan, it would be looking at restrictions that are written in a service plan, so anyone that is bringing that, including a parent, and that's one of the reasons why we amended the bill in the House. It originally just talked about service members or service providers, and we added in family members, guardians, friends, and caregivers in order to make it clear that it's this whole universe of individuals.
Right. I just worried about the word influence. Just because I recognize that it's influence of the commission, sorry.
No, I think it's a very good point, and one that I think we should carry to the department. This, they will come back to us with recommendations about what they need. The bill itself doesn't develop that commission, but it is an ongoing concern. I know you have a bill in this committee, or you had a bill in this committee, we're past the deadline, that I actually support. It's a great bill, but one of the concerns that I have, it talks about having you know, at least one independent living option when you're looking at things, or a supported living option. The only concern that I've had about that I've shared is that for some individuals that are unable to safely live alone, to be sure that parents aren't able to, and guardians aren't able to influence that process to force a person to stay in their home, which, you know, we had in our Ways and Means Committee, Ross, I think many of you have talked to Ross, and it was about the elimination of the Fairview Housing Trust. And somebody asked him what the worst case scenario would be if housing wasn't available. And he said, well, I could be homeless and living in the street, or the worst case scenario, I could have to live with my parents. That was very, very telling. And, you know, people don't want to spend their lives living with their parents if there are opportunities to do that. So that influence can be very well-intentioned, but is also a very real thing. Yeah. Says the woman whose 22-year-old is still living in her house.
Representative Nierman.
Good. Thanks, Chair Kenny Geyer. So thanks for bringing this. So I don't know if I have a question, so I'll just kind of think out loud, and you can comment on it. But if you're going to create a set of rights or acknowledge a set of rights that exists with this person, there's consequences that come with behavior, and so that's why. And I don't necessarily want to make the comparison completely, but that's why, like, children don't have complete rights to do everything. It's because there's consequences, and they're not maybe able to judge what those consequences are. And so I would worry. So I'll just go down the list here of the. There's five things that are enumerated here. So it says choose their friends and visitors. What if one of their friends is a drug dealer that he just met at the bus stop, and now he has a right to say that that's his friend, his or her friend, and bring that person home. Select their own entertainment, and you used some examples of some. You call it inappropriate things, and I can think of things that are far more inappropriate than that. And tend to their own personal hygiene. Would that include not to tend to their own personal hygiene, too? Mm-hmm. And choose their own intimate partners. And does that include the responsibility to care for the offspring that come from that intimacy? And then I think you summed up that food choices pretty well there, but how do we deal with the consequences that come from some of these things? What do we do there?
So, Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Nierman, thank you for that question. It's a very important question. I think within the and first, I really like the way that you talked about it. This isn't granting rights; it's affirming rights that actually exist. And you mentioned children. Children are under the age of 18 as minors. They do not have the same rights as adults do. All of us, upon turning 18, have a series of rights that belong to us. And even in Oregon, where there's a guardianship, I know when I went and I have a guardianship for my son, it is a limited guardianship. It points to very specific things that the court has found are important for him to have guidance and support over making decisions. But in the disability rights community, we talk about something that's called the dignity of risk, that we all have the right to make bad choices and to suffer the consequences of those choices. So to go through your list, just as my son might choose an inappropriate friend that is dealing drugs or doing drugs, so might my daughter, who doesn't have a disability, mm-hmm. and their rights should not be any different. The consequences they face could be the same. The consequences to the people that they live with could be the same. Selecting their own entertainment, I'll take it out of my family so as not to embarrass my kids, but if you had two brothers and you had a 25-year-old without an intellectual disability, he would have the right to go to a strip club or to watch pornography or to purchase things from an adult store. That right should be no less to a person with an intellectual disability because we all get to make those own choices. Tending to personal hygiene, I think we've all met people who have a variety of ways that they prefer to take care of their hair, their body, whether they wear deodorant or not wear deodorant, that you don't lose that right because you're a person with a developmental disability. And we all have the right, and I think probably all of us have at some point chosen, I don't know about the degree of intimacy, but a partner that ended up not being most appropriate for us. And I don't think any of us should have another person coming and telling us who we should love or who we should spend time with or whether or not we should have the right to exercise our sexuality. People with intellectual and developmental disabilities are also sexual beings and have that need and desire for sexual intimacy as well.
Okay.
I found it interesting to see that it came out unanimous out of Human Services, and then there were some of those individuals that then voted no on the floor. Can you express why that is, or did they express?
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark, that was a surprise to me. There was a comment that was made on the floor about an additional unfunded mandate to the Department of Human Services. So I think that there was some concern there that the bill does not have a fiscal, and we've been in conversation with the department around this conversation. So I can't speak to what those changes were. My vice chair didn't, he kind of laughed about it afterwards, but didn't express a significant policy dispute around it. That the only comment made on the floor was whether it was adding to the plate of the Department of Human Services. But you'd have to go and ask those members about why.
So, Senator Gelser, that kind of brings me to a question I had. This is not to create the commission, but it's just to ask the department to come up with a proposal for a commission. So I'm curious as to why you're taking that step, because this must have been on your mind for a while as your own son was reaching adulthood. Is it because of your concerns about our fiscal state right now and wanting that to just play out and not get caught up in that? Or is it because this was something that, with all the other things on your plate, you've only attended to recently and you wanted to make sure there was a really well-thought-out proposal before you brought it to us as a full commission?
So, Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Stark, where this actually came from was less my own son, except for that he turned 18 and I started to have the give you an example. We were on a camping trip, and as young adults sometimes do, his behavior was kind of annoying, and as was my daughter's, and he wanted to go into the camper, and I was like, no, you need to stay out here. And he looked at me and said, no, it's my right to go into the camper. I'm an adult. And I happened to be camping with other people that were in the system, and they're like, hey, HCBS rules. I have to report you. I'm like, fine, go into the camper. That's your choice. You're right. You're an adult. So, it changes the way that you think about things. Even as a guardian, my role with my adult son is different as a guardian than it was as a parent. So that I've just thought about in terms of my own behavior. This really came more from the discussions that we had out of the SACU task force in the interim, the Stabilization and Crisis Unit, and the questions about how service plans are written, how restrictions on daily activities are written. Lilia and I had a number of conversations about how this is handled in other states, and we didn't want to be too prescriptive because there are other places that are already doing this the right way. We were unclear about, at this point, where it should live. Like, would that be, and I really didn't want to get into the whole ombudsman conversation again. There's enough conversation about the Office of Long-Term Care Ombudsman that it really made more sense, since there was an interest within the department of working on this, to actually provide a little bit of an assist to the department, people in the department that were thinking about this, to prioritize that question moving forward. I think the other reason that that it came forward is that with many of the rights that individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities have are actually enumerated in rules like the home and community-based waiver rules. And at the beginning of the session, with questions about whether there would be a repeal of the Affordable Care Act or a wholesale repeal of rules, kind of Medicaid-related rules, whether or not some of these things would go away. And I had a pretty significant interest in, you know, the language at the top that really talks about those basic rights that individuals had and wanted to have a place in our statute that referenced that adults with intellectual disabilities are adults that have these rights. So I like that this directs the department to create this. I also like that it gives us the opportunity to affirm these rights for these individuals.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair. I am obviously thrilled. We've talked before, and there's a population that needs some extra attention and recognition. The question is more sterile. Does this give an adult with a developmental disability any additional rights than, say, my child who's 19 who doesn't have a disability?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Noble, no.
And then does it interfere with the parental right of dealing with my child who is 19 who may have a disability, or dealing with my child who is 19 who does not have a disability? Does it put any additional restrictions on my ability to control my own home and environment?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Noble, no, it does not. Just as with your, if you had a 19-year-old without a disability, and you might, as I know that families have, said these are the house rules, you can stay in the house or you can move on. You could do the same with you can still make your own house rules. What's different would be in a service provider organization. It's actually against federal rules to have house rules for group homes or residential facilities, because you have to have room for those individual rights of the adults who are living in that home as an adult.
Thank you.
Okay, and I think one thing that I would hope, if once the proposal, if this gets enacted and if the department comes up with a proposal that we then see next year, I think one of the things, to get to some of Representative Nierman's questions, would be the rights are there in law. But one of the things I would hope out of this commission would be some of the results of the work group that you and I chaired for the SACU, the Stabilization and Crisis Unit, was a lot of it ended up being around best practice and how to help meet the needs of people and take it out of the realm of rights, because actually they have the rights, but how do you help people make best choices in some of these situations? Like, how do we help service providers and parents and the whole range to advise when there may be particular needs that the IDD population has? So that would be what I would hope would come out of that, actually.
And Chair Kenny Geyer, I think that is important, as well as, you know, we spend a lot of time in high school and in other places talking about giving kids education about how to become an adult, whether they're individuals with or without intellectual disabilities. Right. Sometimes we leave students with intellectual disabilities out of that. I know the Council on Developmental Disabilities and Self-Advocates as Leaders have started developing some of their own trainings, especially around employment. We have adults with intellectual disabilities training other adults with intellectual disabilities about how to seek work, how to be a good employee, how to deal with issues. I've been really pleased. My son's provider has developed developed this life skills curriculum that they're doing through their individual supports, and it's really neat to see things on the ground, how, you know, we're in a resource-constricted time, how do people use those resources, and they have developed a group class that meets once a week, and every week they're doing a different life skill. So it could be riding the bus. They do a unit on healthy relationships. They do a unit on cooking, conflict resolution, nutrition. So all of those things that go into how do we have a range of choices and individuality, and also be thoughtful about taking care of ourselves.
And that's what I would hope. Choices. I see that, you know, we've gone from individuals with intellectual disabilities not having rights to now a system of where they have rights, but then how do you fill in the in-between where you really help people in that community develop the resources they need to exercise those rights in a responsible way. That's what I would hope out of this.
And I think it's a very true thing that needs to be developed. And the last thing that I would say is it still always surprises me to think about how recently it has been that you have an entire population of adults that haven't had rights. I mean, what we're talking about here are really, really basic decisions. And when we hear the conflicts that sometimes come up between families or providers, or some of the debates that we have in the building. And I think for advocates and people that have worked on this, it's very sensitive because these rights have been very, very hard won and are still being very hard won. Basic things. Like, we had a bill on the floor of the Senate the other day about, yes, you get to go to school all day, even if you have a disability. Mm-hmm. The legislation that we work on about, no, we don't take 7-year-olds with autism and lock them in boxes in classrooms, or put mechanical restraints on them. Or the ABLE Act, the idea that, yes, a person with a disability, you can save money and spend money the way that you want. These are really, really basic things. And, you know, one that we still haven't figured out, just because of federal Medicaid and Social Security rules for adults with intellectual disabilities that find that person they want to share their life with, they lose their benefits and their supports if they get married. Mm-hmm. So they can't marry. And if they come from a faith tradition or a family tradition where you cannot live with someone if you aren't married, that is, do I have a partner with whom to share my life and violate my faith and family beliefs, or do I
lose all my resources?
Do I lose all my resources? And that is a very untenable question. And it's just surprising to me that in 2017, people still have to struggle with those very basic rights that most of us take for granted.
Do you remember, Senator Gelser, have you seen the movie where there was a young woman, I believe, living in a group home, and a young man living at home with his family, who met in, I think, some kind of class. Both were IDD, and started dating, having a relationship, and the struggles that they both went through in order to be able to spend any time together. Did you ever see that film?
I have very not seen tender that film, but I have experienced that story from many Oregonians.
Okay. Well, it was a beautifully done film about exactly this issue, and you know, the fear that the parent felt in having her son get involved in a relationship, and some of the struggles that both sides were going through. And it was a very touching, tenderly done film. And I wish I could remember the name, because I saw that, I think, probably 4 or 5 years ago, and I can't remember the name, but it really highlights this issue. Okay, yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Kindergarten, since we're all just kind of offering random thoughts here. but kind of in response
it
to...
It's a random thought.
Damn it, you blew it.
We're discussing this out loud, just the whole concept. So not random, but they weren't questions is what I meant. I guess it was. Did you see the movie?
Yes. Do you remember the name of the movie?
But kind of to Representative Nierman's point, and just with this whole thing, I hope, and I think this is kind of the sentiment of what we, in this building, the conversations I've had, that we want to see us get to the point where, for these individuals, they legitimately have freedom and liberty. You know, and with liberty, that's all the responsibility and the rights and the risks that come with that. And at the same time, as you were saying, we set up, we do our best to put them in a scenario to make best choices. And then we intervene swiftly with justice if somebody abuses them. Mm-hmm. And so there's this whole spectrum of where, yes, they're a greater risk, but that's part of what they take on by having liberty, and we need to be able to intervene when somebody abuses them. Just like if somebody abuses a child, we intervene.
Right.
quickly and swiftly and so forth. So, but finding that balance is tricky, and I think that's why, and I like the fact that you're asking the department to go put together a proposal, those who have been studying this, and bring some people in, as opposed to going straight to the commission, where we say, you know what, no, come back with a well-thought-out, well-researched proposal, and then let's have the conversation where we go from there. So I think this is a great first step on that.
And we have great leadership. I mean, I have such confidence in Lilia Tennity and both the values and leadership that she brings to this program and the proposal that she'll be able to bring forward.
Just real quickly, what states would you recommend I look at that have done a good job on doing this?
So I do not have that list, but Lilia could probably provide that to you. I know Illinois, where she came from, had one.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Representative Nierman. So Arizona has a human rights committee on persons with developmental disabilities. Georgia, Washington. That's what I have listed in my SMS, but okay. I can also look that up for you as well.
That's fine. I'll get it from your SMS. Thanks.
That's great. Well, we actually have other people signed up for this as well.
Great.
But thank you, Senator Gelser, for the robust and sometimes random conversation about it. Okay. So we have Tony Larson, Jamie Degnault, Gabrielle Gudin. Sorry if I'm... Gudin. Come on up.
Kenny Geyer, we also have Joanne Furman.
Would you like to all four come up at once? Great. I was going to call you last just because there wasn't a chair there, but yeah, no, that's fine. Come on up if you're all a group, that's fine. It's all right. Do you want to start?
Hi. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and committee. I'm Gabrielle Gudin. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Staff Advocacy Coalition. I also have a disability. I will be having Jamie Degnault read off some questions for me, interview style.
Okay, great.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, I am providing the support to Gabby as a natural support and not in a paid capacity. So Gabby, who are the Oregon Self Advocacy Coalition members?
Oregon Self Advocacy Coalition members are members from 18 groups throughout Oregon with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
The mission of the Oregon Self Advocacy Coalition is to bring self advocates together to have a unified voice about issues that affect their lives. What does this mean to you and your members?
To be able to speak up for people as well as teach them speak up for themselves on different topics from healthcare to employment to coming to legislative. Mm-hmm. You guys, you actually know a lot of our members, Karen and Ross. So yeah. That's a big part of us is working with you guys.
Great. Jamie, can you just say your name for the record?
I'm sorry. My name is Jamie Degnault, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gabrielle, what is the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition's vision for its for all people with disabilities?
For everyone to be treated equally, because we are equals to you. Yes, we have different ways of doing it, but we are equal. We should be able to work and live where we want, how we want, just like everyone else.
What are some examples of Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition members having their rights limited in group homes?
So I will start off with one. It was actually when I was in the workshop. I was put in a shelter workshop, and one of the parents of the girls that I went to the workshop with said she couldn't have a boyfriend. I'm sorry. It still shocks me. I must apologize. But she said that she wasn't able to have a boyfriend. And I said, why? Why does your mom say that? I don't know. She was a very mature lady as well. So that's a situation of just getting the skills to be able to have a partner. Mm-hmm. Another one is actually one of our members, our new members. She lived in a group home, and they were telling her she couldn't have friends over. And when they did say she could have friends over, it was only when they said she could. So it wasn't really giving her the right to say, okay, I'm going to learn to get up. I'm going to have them leave to be able to get up in the morning to go to work. It was like them saying, nope, this is your bedtime. They got to go.
Mm-hmm. So, Gabrielle, you talked about some of the freedoms that people would like to have. Why are these freedoms important?
It's the rights of any individual, well, any human. We should be able to eat what we want, when we want, as well as listen to the music you want, take a shower, not take a shower. I really liked Senator Gelser's ideas because we do need to be able to have the right to pick our intimate partner, as well as learn the skills to pick the correct person and a safe person.
Why is it important to have a commission review when people's rights are limited?
So we can go back and actually fix the problems that are occurring so the people can have their rights met, and also problem solve when the person's actually needing that extra help to be able to make the correct choices.
The statute asks DHS to develop a proposal. What are your recommendations to DHS to work with the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition to create the proposal?
Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition would like the commission to actually come to one of our board meetings and meet us and get to know us for who we are and our abilities and hear our stories of how we were taught how to live on our own and be safe, as well as having our executive board on the commission, like Ross Ryan, Karen, and other members. We would also like to be able to send out surveys and newsletters on this project to our members so they can give us feedback to bring to you guys.
That's it.
Sorry. Is there another question?
Is there another question?
Thank you for letting me testify today, Chair Kenny Geyer and committee.
Thank you very much. Does anyone want to ask them questions before we move on?
I'm good.
Nope. Okay. Thank you. That was great. I love the interview style. I know Ross does that a lot, too.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and members of the committee, my name is Jamie Daigneault. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, and our job is to advance social and policy change so that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families are welcome and valued in their communities. And 60% of our members, 60% of the members of the council, are people who experience intellectual and developmental disabilities and family members. We believe communities are strongest when all members' rights are respected and people have the supports they need to work and live in their communities as they choose. We have embraced the opportunity presented in the home and community-based services rules that Senator Gelser mentioned because they ensure that the rights of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are protected in their services and that they have opportunities with appropriate supports to be members of their communities in the ways that they choose to live. We also know that people are most successful in their communities when they experience dignity of risk, when their choices are supported by people in their lives, whether these are paid folks or unpaid people, and when they have control over their lives, including their daily schedules. Unfortunately, we're aware that many people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who experience services don't have their rights honored in those services, or they're limited for one reason or another. And we believe a commission would be an excellent way of ensuring that people's rights are honored in their services and that less restrictive alternatives are explored when appropriate and that restrictions or limitations are not in place longer than necessary. If basic freedoms are limited, we're aware. We've had conversations with people who have complained about limitations. Some Senator Gelser has mentioned, some Gabrielle mentioned. A big one that comes up frequently is not being able to eat what you want, when you want, not being able to go shopping when it's convenient for you, not being able to share personal items with your roommates, not having control over your daily schedule. It's very, very simple things that we all enjoy. Although not part of the bill, we hope that the commission would provide for a majority of voting members who are people experiencing intellectual disabilities and family members. This group is directly impacted by services, and any conversation about rights should include this group. We also believe that it would be helpful if the commission provided opportunity for them to hire their own professional experts so that they could receive the best and impartial information possible. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Tony?
Good morning. Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Sanchez and members of the committee. My name is Toni Larson. I'm the Residential Facility Ombudsman within the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Our program is a new one that started. We started opening to homes in July, and we support 2,200 homes statewide for developmental disabilities and mental health, ranging from foster a home to mid-range home sizes through 5 people to 6 to 16 in some instances. We offer advocacy services to individuals living in those homes regarding their life and their quality of life and their rights and how they'd like to live their life. So we offer assistance when called upon. We've visited approximately 15 counties to date. Our model is to personally visit each one of those homes in order to get to know folks. And so we've gotten to know a lot of folks since last July. We've opened approximately 100 cases. And I can tell you that in meeting with those folks and responding to their concerns, they're all covered here in this bill. And their day-to-day life situations and do have very much to do with dignity of risk and the ability to walk into my house to make a sandwich, to talk with my roommates and flop on the bed, and go to the gym 4 times a week, even though maybe my plan says I'll go 3. I might like to go 4 this week. Those kinds of situations come up, very real day-to-day things where people are calling and saying, I just want to feel like this is home. And that's a direct quote from one of the individuals that we've worked with. We've been very pleased to offer that very direct and very personal service statewide and believe it's very important to get to each one of those houses to meet individuals, to be able to talk to them about what it is they're experiencing and what kind of rights that they do have. That's a very difficult thing to translate for people. And there are a lot of wonderful people and elements to this system in providing care, and each has its own approach and its own requirements to provide services. Dignity of risk is a very difficult thing for a system to provide because there is risk involved for the system as well. So there are very few elements where an individual can actually seek assistance just from their perspective and just to say, this is actually what I want and what I need. We enthusiastically support 834, and putting together a look on a commission of this type would be a wonderful support to that. And the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program looks forward to supporting it with information in any way that we can. Thank you very much.
I have a question for you. So when you say we, who is it beside you trying to get out to 2,200 homes? You oversee other ombudsmen like
yes,
Fred Steele does with?
Yes, there are 5 deputies. Currently, I just brought on the last deputy newly about a month ago,
paid positions?
Yes, 5 ombudsmen. We will be recruiting and training certified ombudsmen, much like the long-term care ombudsman program. But as you can imagine, those certified ombudsmen will receive a very unique type of training. The homes that we cover are all smaller in size, so 1 to 5, they're very intimate environments, whether that's a residential facility home or whether it's a foster home. They're very small settings. So it takes a unique type of a person
in order to spend a lot of time in smaller areas and a lot of work to do. We've had tremendous, when we meet folks in the communities from coalition members, peers, self-advocates, interest in becoming certified ombudsman. And so that will also be a unique approach for us to try to pursue that and get people out into their community. So we're hopeful we'll be launching a pilot in that arena sometime in the summer.
So I have a question about balancing rights and then also financial constraints. Walking into the kitchen and being able to grab food or make a sandwich anytime seems very clear to me. Somebody wanting to go out and do shopping when they really want to do the shopping, if you've got several people in a house and one person wants to go at 10 and one person wants to go at 2 and one person, and you've got people living in the house helping oversee the house, I presume. How do you balance that? How do you balance that?
Well, part of it's a conversation about roommates, right?
Uh-huh.
I've had two children so far in college move through and have the one roommate's eating all the food in the fridge,
mm-hmm.
And who's we're out of milk again.
Yeah.
And it's one of those first things I think you learn in a communal environment with roommates, right? Sitting down and talking together about what's what, who has access to what. And some folks have very specific support needs in that arena. There is no doubt. But there's ways to support that at the same time that you give other folks access to what it is that they need. So perhaps that's a separate area of the kitchen. Perhaps that's a separate set of cupboards so somebody has a direct access when they need to be able to manage what their food is and have access to it. Still have access to the kitchen to cook, for example. In an environment where people have very, very varied needs. At the same time, taking into account the staffing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's all a negotiation and talking about who you're living with and how you put that together so that people are happy. Our decisions, there's a consequence to each one of our decisions that we make.
Mm-hmm.
We can be a bad roommate. We can be a good roommate. We could be good to the people that work with us and for us. And that's kind of a learning process. So those things are kind of negotiated and worked out one by one.
Do you have anything to say here?
I think giving them the knowledge to actually be able to make those decisions themselves, but also saying if you had roommates and one of you only has a car, mm-hmm. You cannot all go get groceries when you want to, or just take the car if you're sharing it with someone. So really giving them knowledge and the skills to be able to say, okay, mm-hmm. this is how a good roommate is and there's only one car. Mm-hmm. How are you going to choose how we do this so everyone gets a choice of how it goes and is heard?
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of the skills training that goes into this, I was actually in a shelter workshop. Do you guys know what a shelter workshop is?
Mm-hmm.
Shelter workshop is a place where people with intellectual and developmental disabilities goes and work pennies per product. So I started off in the shelter workshop, but with the skills training that this commission can actually say, well, this person wants to make this goal, but this is what we need to work on to get to this goal.
Mm-hmm.
I went through that. That's how I became the executive director. I had to get that skills training to be able to live on my own and mm-hmm. to learn to clean and just to do the basic things. But I did it
mm-hmm.
with just a little more support,
mm-hmm.
just a little more.
Mm-hmm.
So really just teaching them, mm-hmm. this is how a roommate is. If you only have one car, everyone can't all go out at once.
Mm-hmm.
Just giving them the knowledge. They'll choose what they do with it,
mm-hmm.
but at least you made that attempt to explain it to them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are you ready for me?
Okay. Good morning. Representative Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joanne Furman. And I'm here on behalf of the Oregon the Developmental Disabilities Coalition. The Oregon Intellectual Disabilities Coalition is a group of approximately 30 organizations across the state that promote quality services for people with developmental disabilities in Oregon. Some of these things are very similar to what Jamie talked about with the DD Council, that we've long recognized that when we all live and work in our communities, people are stronger and happier and healthier. The coalition has worked extensively with DHS in implementing the home and community-based setting rules and supported that process along the way. And as we feel like in Oregon, we're really fortunate to have a service system that's built on those strong values, that share those values, and worked very hard to implement those things. And that includes agency providers, families, and advocates. We believe that our system currently does respect the rights of the people that they support. And we support this bill because we acknowledge that no system is perfect. You know, even with all of our greatest intentions and the understanding that, you know, we have a strong provider system, there will be times when this is needed. And we really support that everyone should have a safeguard. Human rights committees have existed in Oregon before. I was around when they closed Fairview and was part of a human rights committee that included family members and people with disabilities and service providers who worked together to monitor that transition as people moved in their community to make sure that people were healthy and safe and that their rights were respected and people had a place to go to express their concerns. And it was a really successful process for everyone involved and created a great opportunity for people. I'm also the co-director of Partnerships and Community Living, and we provide services to people with IDD. And like most of my providers and my peers and other agency providers, we take dignity of the rights and the people we support very seriously. And we really welcome a human rights committee to partner with us in that and in this commitment. Helping people, I mean, some of the questions that you've asked and that have been talked about here today, helping people live full self-directed lives is really complicated, especially when individual support, they have life decisions that have real or perceived risk. And, you know, for example, one that I can share with you that was a couple of years ago, there was a woman that we supported who lived on her own for many years. She had staff with her various times throughout the day, because she needed some levels of help, but she also really valued her freedom and didn't want staff with her all the time. And then her health started to fail a little bit, and she developed some significant risk of aspiration and choking. And the system sort of got together. We're kind of a team-oriented system and sat with her and said, you know, how do we want to keep, what's going to be best to keep you healthy and safe? And there were pieces of that team and parts of our system that said, well, she needs to move someplace where there's 24-hour staff and people can watch her all the time and make sure somebody's there if she chokes, and that's going to make sure she's safe. She strongly disagreed with that decision. And then there was other parts of her team that felt that their job was to really support her choices and wanted to work sort of creatively to figure out how do we create a safety plan and make sure that she's safe where she's at. Ultimately, I mean, she didn't have to leave her home. We were able to figure it out, but it took months to figure that out. There was a lot of just frustration and struggling. In that process, she really felt like her rights were being violated. I think the people who were saying we need 24-hour support felt like they were doing their job to keep her safe. Mm-hmm. Her staff and DSPs who were saying we can figure this out thought they were doing their job to provide a balance for her. And it feels to me like that might have been a really great situation where we could have had a human rights committee help clarify what people's roles were in that when it gets confused. So that's, I just think, one example when this could be
helpful.
What
was the end of that story?
Actually, the end of the story was we were able to create a safety plan that allowed for her to stay in her own home, and she made some choices that she agreed to some restrictions of what was she was going to eat when people weren't around, ultimately her decision to do. Mm-hmm. After a lot of long conversations with lots of people involved, we came to that dignity of risk discussion, right, that everybody, you know, as providers, we feel some responsibility and, quite honestly, some liability around some of those decisions. But our values tell us that that's what people's rights are. Mm-hmm. And we need a system that helps support that. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that's helpful.
Very interesting. Yes.
You know, this was a really complicated situation, and we just really appreciated the opportunity. And I think we could have used the opportunity for a human rights committee to help us through that.
Thanks, Chair Kinninger. So, Joanne, thanks for your testimony, and I appreciate a point that you made of, and I'm kind of paraphrasing you, you said that helping people with intellectual and developmental disabilities to live a full life is complicated,
yes.
And I think that we, as a society, need to absorb some of that complication and suck it up, buttercup. So here's just some very simple things, because I know you're boots on the ground and you do work with intellectual and developmentally disabled people, but should an IDD person have the right to smoke recreational marijuana or drink alcohol? And you can just go down the aisle if you want on that and just answer that question.
I think people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are adults should have the right to engage in any other legal activity than any other citizen does.
So your answer is yes.
Yes. On that.
I feel they should, but they need to just be told what could happen if they do. Mm. Like, if you smoke too much, mm-hmm. you can mess up your lungs, or
right.
it's just like drinking. You overdo it, it's going to put you at risk for this or that. So giving them the knowledge to make be able to say, okay, this is not the best idea for me, so I'm not going to do it. I personally rarely drink just because my medical condition, but I was told the knowledge to be able to make that decision. Also with pot, I was told the risks on my medical condition and then made my own decision.
Mm-hmm. I'm really sorry. I don't mean to be disrespectful. I had a staff who was going to meet with me, so I just want to text him and tell him.
No, just fine.
I have not stood him up. Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Nierman, I also agree that it is as an adult who's 18 or older that or 21, as the case may be, that it is their choice. And in my experience with the folks with developmental disabilities that I know, most of them are, all of them are aware of the consequences and have made responsible decisions when I've been around or just in my conversations about their life experiences. I think it's an important question, and I think it's those kinds of conversations are really important and should be part of conversations that they have with friends, family members, and paid staff that are in their lives.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Nierman, I agree as well that they have the same rights as every other individual, and if it's a legal activity, they have the right to choose that. It's about offering information and talking together about it as a group.
You know, if I could add, I think just to be transparent and honest here, I think there are times when it's not a good idea. And I think there's times when we've gone through all that informed decision-making and helped people make those decisions, and it becomes very unsafe. And but I think then you intervene like we would, mm-hmm. like I would with any other person that I care about, as we get together and we talk about, you know, where you're at and what's happening with here. Sometimes law enforcement gets involved and they make decisions for them. So risk limits to those rights get put on the people we support often by situations outside of anyone's control.
Like I'm guessing, don't give the keys to the car.
Right, right.
Chair Kenny Geyer and committee, I agree with her. In every situation, there is adults that are limited to what they can. They have probation officers, parole officers, everything that like keep them stabilized because it's not the best and they're not going to be able to make that decision. But by them making that mistake and having it corrected like everyone else, that's better than just saying mm-hmm. like hiding stuff from them or mm-hmm. not telling them the truth. Like say, this is going to be a consequence if you continue to do this, mm-hmm. but really giving that them the chance to be able to say it and then have the consequence like everyone else, because then the parole officer, probation officer can actually, I don't remember the difference, I must apologize, but they can coordinate how to make it so they are being more responsible.
Okay. Cool. Any others? Great. Well, this has been a really robust discussion. Really glad we had the time for this. It's one of the luxuries of being in the second part of the session here is that we get a little more time to absorb it. So thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 834. Committee, just wanted to mention that next week we're going to have, on Tuesday, we're going to have Commission on the Blind and Oregon Youth Authority both make presentations to us because we really haven't had a chance to, those are entities that we oversee, but didn't really have time in the first session to hear about what it is they do. How many staff do they have? What are their programs under them? Maybe some budget considerations, since they've had to put presentations together for the budget side. I said, you don't have to do a whole new thing for us, but give us a little bit of what you gave to the budget side. And then on Thursday, we're going to be bringing back for work sessions the bills that we heard this week, and then public hearings on whatever is trickling through the process. The following week, what I'm thinking of doing is having the Department of Human Services and then Housing and Community Services come back. That we've seen a lot of them in the past, but we haven't really had the budget conversation. Again, we're a policy committee, not a budget committee, but given that these discussions are going on, I thought it might be of interest to our committee to hear what are their budgets, what are the proposed cuts, what are, you know, just give us a sense of that, so that, again, you as policy people who are looking at these issues should feel free to have that information and weigh in with the subs in whatever way you'd like. But I want to make sure our policy committee is not completely disjointed from the fiscal committees, the fiscal decisions that are being made on issues that we care about. So that's the intention for the next couple of weeks, and then we'll just see how many bills continue to trickle in. We'd love to do a site visit or a couple site visits at some point, offer that. And so Cassie's going to come up with some options in the close vicinity. It might have to do with child abuse, like at the Liberty House. I think a couple of people may have gone to the Liberty House Child Abuse Assessment Center opening just this last week. I know Representative Meek was there. Several other colleagues, legislators, I saw there. We could go to affordable housing. We could go to a senior center. There's a whole variety of things that we might look at, maybe even OYA. So we're going to come up with a list of things that are in the, and then circulate it to you and see if you have any interest, you know, as we go forward and have a little bit more time. And, you know, if not, well, I know people can value their time if the committee doesn't meet, so we won't meet just for the sake of meeting, just if there's interest and value added to anything. So, okay, with that, we are adjourned. So, okay, with that, we are adjourned.